Hello.
Mic is low, but I know how to tilt it up. Can I?
All right. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce Carl Phillips this evening. I first met Carl just this summer. I was his fellow at the Kenyon Summer Writers Workshop. And before arriving in Gambier, I was, I think it's fair to say, genuinely terrified that I was given the opportunity to make an absolute ass of myself in front of Carl Phillips. Even when Carl wrote me to notify me that I'd received a fellowship, I was certain I'd done something very, very wrong. The email began, "Hello, this is Carl Phillips." And I was sure that the major clause of the sentence that followed was going to be, "And I've been made to contact you on the part of the literary community to ask you to stop writing poetry and to discontinue your involvement with literature in general." I was sure that during the Kenyon workshops, Carl was going to ask me some simple question. "Can you describe for the workshop what a metaphor is?" And I'd respond with some gem like, "It's when a thing is supposed to be another thing, but not really." And Carl would shake his head, maybe draw an index finger across his neck at me, and that would be that. When I met Carl at Kenyon, I met a person who was deeply kind, deeply gentle and funny, and deeply invested in the learning of the students. The workshop lasted only a week. In that week, I learned so much about how poems work, about the ways they can move structurally and grammatically, about the line, or about what the line offers us as writers, about what the sentence offers us as writers, about what lyric and narrative tensions offer us. One thing he spoke about, I keep coming back to, both for myself and when I read through Carl's own poems. And that's the notion that the investigation of a subject in poetry means that at some point you must admit, even only to yourself off the page, that you have, and what you are doing in writing has, a fundamental disconnect with the subjects you take on, and that the authority you offer yourself as a writer must be undermined at least by that. Not just because it adds to the tensions and dramas of the poems, not just because it widens the lens of the poem's occasions, those central and unshakable conflicts that makes any poem necessary, but because this fundamental disconnect, this uncertainty in all aspects of living, is true. It's what all the technical control of poetry, all of its gadgetry of grammar and form and structure, all its inherited and disinherited traditions, is in response to. And it applies to most, if not all, of poetry's central subjects, to grief, to love, to death, even to the other celebrations of life, all of them in some way are anchored both to their own unknowing and to their own hope that giving a form to that unknowing, giving a poem to it, is good and sufficient work. And this way of seeing functions in Carl Phillips' poetry as both underlying theme and process. In his poem, "Frey," he writes, "I woke, as it were. I was not bewildered. The distance as uncrossed as it had been. But now a clarity, like that of vision, a kind of crossing. Parts that the light reached relative to everything else, what the light kept missing. Spirea in wind, wind in Spirea's leggy branches. I could make distinctions, weeping, fruit, weeping, maple. I could love you as I have loved you, as only humans can love each other. It's a human need to give shapelessness a form." More and more, Carl Phillips' work needs no introduction. The way his unfolding, slippery, sometimes playful syntax both navigates its way through and unsettled to the solemn, sometimes melancholic meditations and landscapes. The way he gives a kind of liveliness to the sonic environments of his poems, a liveliness that can lift the poems or settle the poems into the griefs and alienations of the speaker. The way he almost unnoticeably manipulates the sentence and extends or fragments it, and the way he uses these extended and fragmented sentences to surprise and sustain the lyric moments in which his poetry frequently exists. Most of you know all these characteristics, Carl Phillips' work already. You don't need me to give language to them. But I'd like to return briefly to the notion of uncertainty I was speaking of earlier, to offer up one final point. In so much as Carl Phillips' poems are navigations of uncertainty, and in so much as their navigations are through landscapes of grief, of isolation, of the sometimes somber and dire. What always strikes me in the poems is their consoling power, their gentility and kindness in leading us as readers through their speakers' resonating difficulty. That gentility, which is another human need, both in terms of the expression of gentility and in our hunger for gentleness, especially when the narratives and meditations of our lives lead us to direness, is Carl in the poems. His gentility and generosity, his part, his existence, in all this shapelessness, that there is room for a form that can be sufficient and good and gentle. Gentle enough to console and repair. Carl Phillips is the author of 13 books of poetry, most recently Reconnaissance and Silverchest. A new volume, Wild as the Wind, will be published in 2018. His latest book of prose is The Art of Daring, Risk, Restlessness, Imagination, and he has translated Sophocles' Philoctetes. A four-time finalist for the National Book Award, his honors include the Penn USA Award in Poetry, the Los Angeles Times Book Group Prize for Poetry, the Kingsley Cuffs Award, two Lambda Literary Awards, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Library of Congress, and the Academy of American Poets. Currently the judge for the Yale Younger Poet Series, Phillips teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. Please help me welcome Carl Phillips.
Pursued ruthlessly until at last it was ours, what would the difference have been finally? What I've called the world continues to pass for one. The room spins, same as ever. The bodies inside it do, flightless, but no less addicted to mastering, to the dream of mastering, the very bowels through which they keep falling without motion almost. That slowly, it seems they'll fall forever, my pretty consorts, to whom sometimes, out of pity, not mercy, for nothing tender about it, I show the darker powers I've hardly shown to anyone. Feel the weight of them, I say, before putting them back, just behind my heart, where they blacken and thrive. So can you do that? Okay, good. That was just a test. It's called Last Night. Then he said it was like learning the hard way, as in too late, that maybe recklessness is overrated. And though I disagreed, I did not say so. I disembarked instead. Behind me, the skiff keeps nudging the pier, rough sets diminishing or just now revealing itself. A distinction that, from here, I can see matters. It should. It should have. Sometimes the light can seem to stand in for reluctance. Last night, the dark did. I have rested my hand on the beloved's head. As with regret, so too with prayer. His skull, my hand. There's a trembling inside the both of us. There's a trembling inside us both. It's bold, it's called discipline, short. More theatrically than I expected, the trapped hummingbird won't stop beating the mason jar's glass. The staghorn sumac's splayed geometry tilts on the wind. You are the knife, and you are also what the knife has opened, says the wind. Read. And the last book from this book is called Foliage. It's something like a lot of wine, I'm putting it. Refreshing. Foliage. Cage inside a cage inside a whispering so deep that. And then just the two of us. And you calling it vulnerability. And me calling it rumor passing through suspicion's fingers. Ashweed, flickering halo of the boy I might really have been once. Tiger lilies beneath a storm blowing into, then out of character, then back again, as if seasonal. Summer now, now fall. But I know suspicion has no fingers. Vulnerability is just part of the trash that rumor leaves behind. Waited out long enough, the trash shifts. It always does. In that way, it's like memory lately. I'm the fist of instinct, cool, unstoppable. You're the dogwood's crucifix-laden branches. I'm the fist, through the branches. You're the fist, I'm the branches. So, a little violent note. You want to pleasant activities like swimming. That's what this poem is called, swimming. Some nights, I rise from the latest excuse for why not stay a while. Usually that hour when the coyotes roam the streets as if they've always owned the place and come back inspecting now for damage. But what hasn't been damaged? History here means a history of storms rushing the trees for so long their bowed shapes seem a kind of scar. Worth trusting, I mean, as in how the helmsman steering home knows what star to lean on. Do people anymore even say helmsman? Everything in waves, or at least wave-like, as when another's suffering, being greater, displaces our own, or I understand it should, which is meant to be different, I'm sure of it, from that pleasure Lucretius speaks of, in witnessing from land a ship foundering at sea, though more and more it all seems related. I love the nights here. I love the jetty's black ghost finger, how it calms the harbor, how the fog hanging stranded just above the water is fogged finally. Not the left-behind parts of those questions from which I half wish I could school my mind, desperate cargo, to keep a little distance. An old map from when this place was first settled shows monsters everywhere once the shore gives out. It can still feel like that. I dive in, and they rise like faithfulness itself, watery pallbearers heading seaward, and I, the raft, they steady. It seems there's no turning back. This is where I feel I should say something. I know what I'm saying. So, but there, that's been something. This is called musculature. last dog I owned, or more humanely put, so I'm told, that I used to live with. She'd follow me everywhere. She died, potentially. I put her down as more the truth. It is the truth. And now, this dog, that I mostly call Sovereignty, both for how sovereignty, like fascination, can be overrated, and for how long it's taken me just to half understand that. Pretty much my whole life. Mortality seemed an ignorable wilderness, like any other. The past seemed what occasionally it still does, a version of luck, when luck, as if inevitably, gets stripped away. What hope otherwise for suffering? When did honesty become so hard to step into and stay inside? I'm not saying forever. I could last a fair time on a small while. Sovereignty sleeps hard beside me. I pass my hands down the full length of him, like a loose command through a summer garden. Let those plants that can do so lean away on their stems toward the sun. I do feel the need to say out my dog's name is not Sovereignty, which would be really obnoxious. His name is Ben. But it seemed, at the time, it seemed right for the fall. So, yeah. It's kind of like disturbing me that 5 minutes have come from. 3 minutes are going to go fast. Which sometimes when I'm at a reading of other people, I'm grateful for. So this is called Gold Leaf. It's not very long, but it is one long sentence, so let's wash over you, I guess. Gold Leaf. To lift without ever asking what animal exactly it once belonged to, the socketed helmet that what's left of the skull equals up to your face, to hold it there, mask-like, to look through it until looking through means looking back through the skull, into the self that is partly the animal you've always wanted to be, that, depending, fear has prevented or rescued you from becoming, to know utterly what you'll never be, to understand in doing so what you are, and say no to it, not to who you are, to say no to despair. Also a fragment, though. I think that's not even simple. This is called Several Birds in Hand, But the Rest Go Free. For what it's worth, the initial context is this restored prairie that I hang out in a lot in St. Louis. So I can imagine walking through a restored prairie. Several birds in hand, but the rest go free. Hiking the restored prairie was more than lovely enough. I could appreciate the good signage, got a chance to forget or change, to respect fear. Were they happy? In any real way, whatever real is, those first pioneers. The happiest people I know are those whose main strategy has always been detachment. I've been working on that. Not so long ago, for example, a sentence like, "The skin where you burned me last week with your cigarette is almost healed completely," was so much harder to say. Progress. The way blue stem, mallow, purple globes of clover, when set together, make a kind of music, though they're nothing alike. Pale colors in a tall field, all the prairie comes to. True pity, as in deeply felt. I save mine, what's left of it, for the wounded animals, the ones not yet dead. Already, I don't mean anymore the soft, dark, violent, rustling wilderness inside the bright one that I was before when I say wilderness. It's called Straight. I have this friend. Yes, not really. Who said, you know, you live in a city, why don't you write an urban poem along with you? So I attempted to write this urban poem. Though then later, when I read it to him, he said it's just got a lot of flowers in it. So, whatever. But that's. This is that poem. It's called Stray. When he speaks of deserved and undeserved as more than terms, how they can matter suddenly, I can tell he believes it. Sometimes a thing can seem star-like when it's just a star, stripped of whatever small form of joy likeness equals. Sometimes the thought that I'm doomed to fail, that the body is, keeps me almost steady. Its steadiness is what the gift for a while brings. Feathers, first and last, pods of milkweed, October, before it all fades away. Before the drugs and the loud music, before tears and restraining orders, and the eventual, go fuck yourself, get your ass out of here, don't go. The apartments across the street were a boys' grammar school. Before that, a convent, the only remains of which, ornamenting the far parking lot, is a marble pedestal with some Latin on it that translates, heart of Jesus, have mercy, as if that much at least still remained relevant or should. If it's true that secrets resist always the act of telling, how come secrets, more often than not, seem the entire story? Palladium, pleomi, how delicate this holding of certain words in the mouth, the all but lost trick of lifting for salvage the last windfalls as across them the bees make their slow muscled, stunned, moving scab. Alright, it's called From a Bonfire. I actually really dislike persona poems, but now I wrote it. Or it turns into one. Suddenly, a bonfire is speaking, which is absurd, but so are persona poems. So, this is called From a Bonfire. There's plenty I miss still that I wouldn't want back, which I'm beginning to think might be all regrets ever had to me, and there's maybe no shame then in having known some, and all those years, I've pretty much been wrong. Not that being wrong means wasting time, exactly, but hasn't been useful. Having grown up with bonfires each October, having equated them with fall, the communion especially of leaves falling, fire as what both defined the dark, easily taken for granted, and kept the dark at bay. Surely that's been worth something, for it stays with me. In that way, it even now marks a difference between who I was and what I've since become, a kind of bonfire myself, unattached, though, to any time of year in particular. Instead, a season of the mind entirely, as unpredictable in occurrence as in intensity, cracked, blue, forever half done departing, not so different after all, maybe, from the darkness against which I'm at once more apparent and somehow more betrayed. What has restlessness been for? The darkness asks, as if that were the question, when the darkness itself is its own question, the most honest one left, as far as I can see, that's worth asking, that I keep meaning to ask, then faltering, not at all out of fear, I think. I don't think I'm afraid, but being fire and restless. All right. this poem is called, or it is called, what I see is the light falling all around us. I read at this high school today, and it's great, and they were asking me something about where I got titles from, and at the time I told them what I could think of, which is I get a lot from indie rock bands, and lyrics from Ben. But I also have this new thing where I can't think of a title, so then I go to an old poem of my own and just take a line from it and make that a title. And it doesn't feel like stealing, because I wrote the poem. So this is one of those. The title is What I See is the Light Falling All Around Us, but it's from some old poem. To have understood some small piece of the world more deeply doesn't have to mean we're not as lost as before. Or so it seems this morning. Random bees stirring among the dogwood blossoms, a few here and there stirring differently somehow, more like resisting stillness. Should it come to winnowing my addictions, I hold on hardest, I'm pretty sure, to mystery. Though just yesterday, a perfect stranger was so insistent that I looked familiar, it seemed easier in the end to agree we must know each other. To his body, a muscularity both at odds and at one with how fragile everything else about him, I thought, would be if I could see inside. What's the word for the kind of loneliness that can feel like swimming unassisted in a foreign language for the very first time? I don't know. That's why the poem ends that way. I'm sure that would be. Okay, this is called If You Go Away, which is not from, the title is not from an indie rock band. It's a song, I want to say Nina Simone, but I could be wrong about that. More than one person, but anyway, it's an old song, If You Go Away. When death finds me, if there be sight at all, let me see as the torn coyote does, turning its head briefly, looking not with understanding, but recognition, at where the flesh falls open around a wound that more resembles the marsh violet's petals, that hard to detect at first darkening that happens soft, steadily, toward the flower's throat. Why not let go of it, I used to think, meaning that instinct by which the body shields itself from what threatens it unexpectedly. A fist, the next so-called unbearable question that's bearable after all, voila, surprise. I know that's an abstraction, but I prefer a shape to things, though the shapes are changeable. In my latest version, death is a young man with a habit for using one side of his mouth to blow his hair slightly up from his brow, while with the other half he mutters things like, each time I leave, it's like I've left forever. Behind him, stray cabbage moths lifting up from the catalpa's blossoms make it seem as if one bloom had flown free from the others, fluttering mirror from a clutch of still ones. There's a kind of love that doesn't extend itself both ways between two people equally, because it doesn't have to. This is called His Master's Voice. Having that moment where I'm thinking, why are they all looking at me? It's freaking me out. But it'll be over soon. His Master's Voice. See, that's the thing you're not getting, though. The part about honesty being, at worst, a bruising experience, at best, a bruisable one. I woke regretting everything all over again. Since when is that a crime? And then woke wanting the kind of sentence whose unfolding brings to mind a road so untraveled that indistinguishable brown birds do their dust bath thing right there in the middle of it, to either side the shot bedraggled of wild dahlias, their fake blooming, fake looking postures of half collapse, swoon of summer, the heat behaving the way eventually the facts do, with the truth more difficult to touch than usual. That same haloing out around it, think sea anemones, when seen from above, through water, and softly waking. I was asked last night if I wanted to get married to my partner. My partner didn't ask me this. Well, I said no. But at one point I did, and I thought, well, I'll just imagine the way. So it seems safer that way than actually doing it. So this is called the wedding. Where there's nothing but shade ever. He plants sea oats and ferns, lamb's ears for the soft down that covers them, that he calls fur. His shadow garden. A grown man, around whom the air itself sometimes seems to tremble, like a man trying hard not to, lest he seem unmanly. For his own part, he says, mercy may well be the better part of conquest, but take no prisoners. It's gotten him this far. Why mess with it now? Things like that, out of nowhere. And then, as if the truth required it, his version anyway, full stretches of silence for hours after, long enough to start dreaming up impossible reasons for why the pines barely move, like it's because they've gone stiff with superiority over the other trees, doomed to leaflessness soon enough. Let them strut, if that's strutting, he'll say, addressing who knows what, the clouds, his hunting dogs, as if it made no difference. And this once, so much of life already gets spent fucking lost and we're getting fucked by it, he said, looking hard at me. Don't you want to find happiness? Yes, to a degree. I do. But too much is not good for you. Okay, this is called The Way One Animal Trusts Another. Somewhere between what it feels like to be at one with the sea and to understand the sea as mere context for the boat whose engine refuses finally to turn over. Yeah, I know the place. Stumbled into it myself once. Twice almost. All around and in between the two trees that grow there, Tree of Compassion and, much taller, Tree of Pity, its bark or bronze. The snow settled as if an openness of any kind meant as well a woundedness that, by filling it, the snow might heal. You know what I think? I think if we're lost, you should know exactly where by now. I've watched you stare long and hard enough at the map already. I'm beginning to think I may never not be undecided about all sorts of things. Whether snow really does resemble the broken laughter of the long abandoned when what left comes back big time. Whether gratitude is just a haunted space, like any other. This place sounds daily more like a theater of war each time I listen to it. Loss, surprise, victory, being only three of the countless fates, if you want to call them that, that we don't so much live with, it seems, as live for now among. If as close as we're ever likely to get, you and I, is this close. All right, there are three poems left. I always think it's nice to know that kind of thing. And they're not in sections, numbered sections. Because that happens a lot, too. Okay, so three poems. Now, this one does mention Virgil and Marcus Aurelius, but I like to think you don't have to know anything except they wrote poems a long time ago, or stuff. They wrote stuff. Okay, it's called Not the Waves as They Make Their Way Forward. Like Virgil, Marcus Aurelius died believing that his triumphs, when pitched against his failures, had come to very little. I don't know. Given the messiness of most lives, humble, legendary, all the rest in between, their interiors, I mean, it's hard to say he was wrong. Black night, black train, freight of worries, things that stay the same. Having reached that point that even the luckiest sometimes never get close to, where desire at last offers nothing more nor less than what we string can, Marcus Aurelius wrote down some thoughts meant apparently only for himself, though they became Meditations, a book without which, by now, he'd pretty much be forgotten. It begins with gratitude. How it ends is painful, if I'm remembering right. But it isn't pain. It's called Crossing, it's called Crossing. Now that, at best, we'd rode halfway across the woods that we mostly thought of our lives as, despite the fact of water. Accepting our position and understanding it still mattered, but not like remembering what the point had been, why we set out at all, from the very start. To release something, but what? Whatever the erotic version might be of a soul we ourselves scarce believed in, a persuasive sound to that, but if nothing else, we'd at least learn to trust sound only so far, even as we've had to figure out the hard way to stop giving out trust as if trust were sex, and not what more often just gets confused with sex. Above us, what sang like water was just the wash of trees, now moving, now at rest in a wind's disruption. A slight rustling beneath us, as of fruit unfalling from the ground it fell to, each time we lift our oars free of the waves and steady them there, resting, shadows in a mirror, bruises on the larger bruise of the sea's black face. Now, I'll just end with this poem. It's called Wild as the Wind, which too is a song sung by Nina Simone. I was telling the kids at the high school today that how, what was the question? I think it was, have you ever written a poem or something based on Luby? And no, was the answer. But I said, but I have a poem whose title came to me at the end of an episode of Mad Men, which, when Don Draper and his wife realized they're going to break up, and then fade to black, and they played Nina Simone's version of Wild as the Wind. And I thought, I think that's going to be the name of a poem that I'm going to write. So, there you go. So it's useful to watch TV. Wild is the wind. About what's past, hold on when you can, I used to say. And when you can't, let go. As if memory were one of those mechanical bolts, easily dismountable, should the ride turn rough. I lived in those days, at the forest's edge, metaphorically, so it can sometimes seem now, though the forest was real, as my life beside it was. I spent much of my time listening to the sounds of random, unknowable things dropping or being dropped from, variously, a middling height or a great one, until by winter, it was just the snow falling, each time like a new, unnecessary taxonomy or syntax for how to parse what's plain. Snow, from which the occasional lost hunter would emerge every few or so seasons, and just once, a runaway child, whom I gave some money to and told no one about, having promised. You must keep what you've promised very close to your heart. That way you'll never forget, is what I've always been told. I've been told quite a lot of things. they hover, some more unbidden than others, in that part of the mind where mistakes and torn wishes echo as in a room that's been newly cathedraled, so that the echo surprises. Though lately it's less the echo itself that can still most surprise me about memory. It's more the time it takes, going away. A mouth opening to say, I love sex with you too, it doesn't mean I want to stop my life for it, for example. Or just a voice, mouthless, asking, since when does the indifference of the body stance when we're alone, unwatched, in late life, amount to cruelty? For the metaphysical poets, the problem with weeping for what's been lost is that tears wash out memory, and by extension, what we hoped to remember. If I refuse increasingly to explain, isn't explanation, at the end of the day, that the sturdy truths most resist? It's been my experience that tears are useless against all the rest of it, that if I could, I'd forget. That I keep wanting to say should count at least for something. I'm not done with you yet. Thanks very much.